This is the podcast for Wednesday, January 18th, 2012, Theories of Knowledge. So we just watched this video about the allegory of the cave. Instead of me explaining it and making crude drawings on the board here, you got a nice claymation presentation of it. And a sort of capsule summary of Plato's famous allegory.
So what do you think that... what's that allegory about?
Okay, it's about something about philosophy, right? Who is the philosopher in the story? Or what is the cave? Like an analogy, everything stands for something. Yeah.
As you pointed out, perception of reality, what you know as being truth or real.
Okay, so it's the cave. It's about, how about we say perception or appearance,
I don't know,
versus reality. And maybe something about higher knowledge, or maybe just about knowledge in general, about the possibility of knowledge. What else? Somebody said philosophers. Who's the philosopher in the story? Yeah, it's the escapee. And then who do his friends represent?
Society as a whole.
Yeah. So the people, the prisoners. Our society, or you might just say us, you know, each one of us, before enlightenment. And so this analogy, he goes out into the world, the real world, which is different than the world inside the cave. And notice that what's his reaction when the guy escapes? What happens?
He tries to share it with his companions.
After he sort of adjusts everything, he comes back and tries to share it. But before that,
what kind of enlightened with a certain truth and reality? Has his perception changed?
Uh huh. Yeah. So he's enlightened, and he realizes what something about his beliefs in the cave. Yeah.
He's blinded. He's blinded by the knowledge He is receiving this knowledge that all of a sudden his world is larger. He has a completely different view of understanding of what life is, and he wants to share it with the people that he loves.
Yeah, so when he comes out, he's not used to the brightness of the sun. And the sun actually stands for something particular in the analogy, too. But he's not used to the bright sun. You ever come out of, like, a matinee in the movie theater? You know, you come out, like, on a Saturday afternoon, and it's like the theater's all dark in your eyes. It takes a while to adjust. Or say you're sleeping in on a weekend, and maybe when you're a kid, and your parent comes over and pulls up the blinds, and the sun comes in, right, and you're disoriented for a while, you can't see anything as your eyes adjust. And the idea is that after being out in the real world, he sort of adjusts and understands this reality, which is different than the reality that he had accepted when he was in the cave. And then he goes back and tries to convince his fellow prisoners who are still trapped in the cave. So what do you think, what is trapped in the cave, what is it? What does that represent? Like being chained up or being in darkness. Yeah, maybe being closed-minded or just being, what's another word for that?
Conforming.
Okay. Or maybe being trapped in the cave, being trapped and chained in the cave.
Represents the lack of knowledge.
Yeah, it represents ignorance. Before you're enlightened, whereas as going outside the cave, outside is the real world. enlightenment. I think a little stronger than justification, but like real knowledge.
We can put knowledge here too.
Whereas here, inside the cave, you have ignorance, and I think the world of appearances. And for Plato, this is tied up heavily with the senses. And in Plato's way of thinking, the problem with the prisoners is they say, well, if I can't see it and touch it and feel it, I'm not going to believe it. But what do they see, touch, and feel? Well, the hard cave walls and distorted shadows. And they take the shadows for reality. But there's a greater reality that they don't understand. And in order to understand it, they're going to have to break free from what? How might you describe breaking free of the analogy? What's that supposed to mean?
A willingness to try to learn new things. Or actually, even more than a willingness, it's a drive.
Willingness to what did you say?
A drive to learn new things.
And I think particularly by learning new things, I mean, maybe they will say, well, I learned stuff about the shadows. There's this shadow and that shadow, and here's this shadow relates to this that shadow this way. But it's all still appearances. Yeah.
Maybe letting go of what you already know.
Yeah, so maybe, and what's another word for that? I mean, do you just let... that might be an okay analogy for... What does it mean to let go of something you think you know? How about that? Yeah.
Accept something different?
Okay, sure. So you can accept something different. But accepting something different means questioning what you think you know. Yeah.
When you're doing that, how can you tell? Or maybe do we get some guidance on this as to how do we know if we're the one that has actually left the cave and seen the light? Shouldn't this exist on several levels? You know what I mean? You're not going to go out in the world and see the light and know everything. You're going to have stages of that throughout your life. And certain people are going to go certain ways. How do you analyze? Does it give us some direction on how to figure out if we've even left the cave?
I think this analogy doesn't. Plato has some ideas of his own about how you get knowledge. And Plato is... the first person, well, I don't say he's the first rationalist, because there were some other people before him, but he's the first person that really expanded the theory of rationalism. There were a few of the natural philosophers. There was a guy named Parmenides and who had a rationalist type view. But Plato is really the person who's most associated with it in ancient philosophy. There's a question about whether Parmenides is really a philosopher in the truest sense or whether he's doing something else. And he's called one of these people called the pre-Socratic philosophers. And they're called pre-Socratics because they came before Socrates, who's the father of philosophy. So, breaking free of the cave means willingness to question your pre-existing beliefs and even what you might call common sense. And a lot of kind of basic philosophy, particularly epistemology, is questioning common sense. And you see this in Descartes, where he starts out and says, well, I learned all these things when I was a boy, and everybody in my society believed these things. But now I'm wondering whether they're really true and how I can tell whether the beliefs I have now are true or false, whether they match up with reality or not. And what I'm going to try to do is to try to see, I'm going to try to question everything I believe and see what's left. And if there's a belief left that I can't possibly doubt, that it's impossible to sort of poke holes in, then that's going to be the foundation for knowledge. And Plato has a similar sort of idea. He has... a famous quote from Plato, the unexamined life is not worth living. And by examination, he means, this is Plato, I suppose he was last Socrates. This is actually in the Apology of Socrates, so probably an actual quote from Socrates. And I may have mentioned before that when you look at the beginnings of philosophy, it starts out with, this is the 2 or 3 class, and sometimes I'm not sure what I talked about in which class, but Socrates is really the father of philosophy, followed by his student Plato, and then Aristotle. And Socrates and Plato, it's kind of hard to tell them apart because Socrates never wrote anything. So everything we have about Socrates comes from the mouth of Plato. Plato writes these dialogues, sort of like built off the plays, in which Socrates is the main character. And so most people think that, well, early on it's mostly Socrates. In the middle of Plato's career, it's probably half and half. And near the end of Plato's career, you can kind of see some ideas that you don't see in the early dialogues. And it's probably mostly Plato. And so anyway, you have a Plato. who we might see as like the father of rationalism, and Aristotle, Plato's student, the father of empiricism. And I don't think we're probably not going to do too much with that Aristotle's epistemology, because we're going to spend a lot of time on the 17th and 18th century empiricists like David Hume and George Berkeley and John Locke, and so I can only cover so many people. But I think Plato is important because he's sort of the Plato slash Socrates, really the father of philosophy. So the allegory of the cave is meant to get you to think about a couple of issues. One is, how do you know what you believe is true? And another is tied up with the senses. So if you think about your senses, a question, you might see that this world of appearances or common sense, the beliefs that most people have or that society has, they seem caught up with the senses. And Plato says relying on the senses is a mistake. And we'll look, I think, more on Descartes' questions later on. We're going to focus on Descartes, but Plato has the same sort of idea of if you just go on how things seem on your senses, you really can't get true knowledge of the world. Knowledge has to be based on reason. It can't be based on appearances. And the senses just give you appearances, according to Plato. So, anything else in this analogy I left out, or a question about it? Comments? Rationalism says knowledge comes through reason. And that the senses play a minor or secondary role. You know, if they play a role at all. Like Parmenides didn't think you could trust the senses at all. He was like a sort of a radical rationalist. You get this sort of idea too, I think, in certain forms of Hinduism and Buddhism, this idea that there's the world of appearances that your senses tell you, but then there's this higher reality you get in touch with when you meditate or when you contemplate certain ideas. And Plato has a sort of mystical bent in that he doesn't trust the senses, and he thinks that you can intuit these sort of higher forms of knowledge based on pure reason and logic. And so he's famous for, Plato is, for this theory of forms. The Greek word form is probably a bad translation of for the Greek word. The Greek word used, the theory of forms. You could just call it his theory of ideas or his theory of concepts. And Plato's theory is that there's a world of ideas that are more real than the material world. And so he thinks that there are these absolute ideas like the concept of man. And the concept of man exists in this ethereal realm of ideas. And that individual men are
instances of the form, and the form man actually causes these individual men to exist. So you have like, you know, Mo, Larry, Curly. And they're like all, they all, Plato says they all participate in the form man. So, and to understand the nature of humanity, you have to understand what all men have in common, which is understanding this form here. And individual appearances will just show you particulars. They won't show you this universal. The universal, the concept of man, is something that applies to each and every man. You can look at, like say you look at an individual person, like you look at Curly, and Curly has no hair. And so you might say, okay, so a man is like, it's got a head with like this sort of shaped like a cue ball, and it's smooth on top, right? And then men tend to be kind of pudgy, and they make funny sounds when they're in trouble. And you know, Larry, oh, you'd say, oh, wait a minute, no, I had that wrong. Men actually have crazy curly hair coming out of the sides of their head, but it's still smooth on top. Or, you know, you see Mo, oh, no, they have dark hair, and it's sort of like smoothed down. So all the particulars of these three individuals isn't going to give you knowledge of what humanity is. You have to look at what all they have in common. Now, this is a kind of weird way of thinking, in that Plato thinks that this is the real thing, the concept. The particulars are kind of like a shadowy illusion created by the real idea. Whereas, as most, you know, people today would say, oh, well, no, he's got it backwards. And that's actually what Aristotle says. Aristotle says, no, Mo, Larry, and Curly are what's real. The concept of man or humanity is just an abstraction. It doesn't really exist. So this whole debate about, you know, whether universals exist or whether just particulars exist is actually, it's to some extent, still an ongoing you know, debate in philosophy. But I think most people would say that these particulars, even though they might not give you, you know, abstract knowledge, that they're important. Yeah, they're an important step in giving you abstract knowledge. In other words, the particulars alone isn't going to give you abstract knowledge. But if you put a bunch of particulars together, and specifically sensations, that you can kind of build them up using reason to create knowledge. And that's what the later empiricists will say. Yeah.
So, is the difference between the way Plato and Aristotle attacked this issue, the difference between macro and micro, kind of the way you would envision the problem? One of them really looks for the big chunks and doesn't really give, you know, realizes that there's going to be variation and doesn't really deal with the variation, whereas the other one looks at the variation and tries to look up. Is that a fair assumption?
I don't think it's the micro-macro doesn't really capture it, but I think there is something you said about the sort of big picture. Like universals, they cover, universal knowledge covers everything. And so think about this as being conceptual knowledge, like knowledge of concepts, of logic, of universal truths, whereas particulars are really caught up with the senses. Sensation. So we might say sensation, and maybe here logic or ideas. So like the concept of justice, that's a universal. That's something that's a piece of abstract knowledge. And you can't really get a concept of justice just by looking up and seeing, you know, oh, there's some guy in an old movie from the 50s being blasted by a fire hose because he's black. Oh, and you say, oh, that's unjust. But then you say maybe look at something else, like a current injustice. What injustices are going on in the world today? Really flagrant ones.
The pepper spraying in those kids.
What's that?
Or at UC Davis, those kids who got pepper spraying.
I don't know. Some people say they got what they deserve. They obey a lawful order. But I don't know. That's kind of controversial, right?
The continent of Africa.
What's that?
The continent of Africa.
Yeah, I mean, I look at people like genocide in the villages, like you have the Janjaweed militias coming down, and again, you know, the victims here are not African Americans, but they're African Africans, and they're being attacked because of their religion, also because of their race.
and just being whole villages being slaughtered. It's like Darfur is a sort of hotbed of this stuff that's going on. It's kind of the UN's gone in there and things have kind of calmed down, but there's still atrocities going on, and then there's people starving to death and people not helping them in wealthy first world countries. So you look at and again, I don't want to generalize about the whole African continent, but you know, if you just sort of go on averages, people in these African nations tend to be poor and not get enough to eat and live under paltry conditions outside of sort of the a few, you know, urban centers and that's places like Nairobi and so on. So if you think about all those acts of injustice, what is it that they all have in common? And that's going to give you knowledge of justice in general. So you have like this concept of justice. You can't just look at, you know, individual things like, protester, fire hose, that's the first. And we could say, oppression. I'll just put oppression in. I'll just use Darfur since that's a kind of a modern example, a particular one. Darfur, oppression and genocide in Darfur. And then we could have a third one. Yeah, I don't want to say it was better. Okay, so what's going on in Syria?
Guantanamo Bay
is kind of an iffy thing, too. It's like, I don't want to say like I agree completely with the policy, but it's controversial. I mean, if you like do a poll, like half Americans think it's a good idea. So let's just take like Syrian. Attack on protesters, again with the protesters. Is there an example of injustice which doesn't have to do with protesters?
Absolutely.
What's like just one more example, maybe?
The one child policy in China. Mm-hmm.
Child policy. How about else? That might be controversial too, but.
Tiananmen Square.
Okay. How about Southern America? Modern America. Because of the
injustice in modern America?
What's that?
Unemployment?
Is that really injustice?
It's just economy.
It's tough to think of uncontroversial examples, right? So
social security.
Again, controversial example. I might agree with you, but anything else? Death penalty. You know, some guy that's like a child rapist and murderer, you know, does he really deserve to be taken care of for the rest of his life? Chemtrails. Okay, well, just fill in your favorite. Why don't you fill in your favorite example of injustice?
Marijuana
prohibition. Really, I heard Mark Levin going off on the prohibition of drugs. It was just for someone who claims to be a constitutionalist, it was just a big train wreck. Talking with some Ron Paul supporter. It's horrible. So just think about it. People being thrown in jail or fined or having their student aid taken away because they're choking on a joint. So all these examples, and the question is like, could you understand the concept of justice by looking at one of these instances? See some guy getting beat by the police for no reason. And you say, though, that's injustice. But do you really understand the concept of injustice by looking at that particular... Can you observe injustice?
So, you can on a whole, but it's hard to do on a single incident.
Yeah, so this idea of the concept, like an abstract concept like justice, it's universal. And so what Plato would say would be each of these instances... participate in the concept of justice, but the concept of justice is really something that is beyond each one of them. And so that knowledge itself has to be conceptual, it has to be universal. And once you have this conceptual knowledge, like you say you have a working definition of injustice, then you can look at any particular case and see whether it's just or unjust. But it's a form of abstract knowledge that you have to apply to the particulars. Whereas the empiricist would say, well, what you want to do is look at all these individual instances and try to figure out maybe what they have in common, and then sort of build up a concept from the individuals. So it's this, and we'll talk about this some more, the debate between rationalism and empiricism, but a lot of it has to do with, Plato would say, for example, look, you can't understand the concept of justice just by looking at some guy being unjustly condemned, say. You show up at Socrates' trial, Socrates is given the death penalty, you think he doesn't deserve it. You don't have knowledge of justice, you can't observe it like you can observe a color or a shape or motion. It's not something you see with your senses, it's something you intuit with your mind. And so in that case, Plato says, therefore, knowledge of abstract concepts is knowledge of these eternal forms or eternal ideas or concepts. So that's the kind of the rationalist take. And you'll get more of a feel for this, I think, as we go on and talk about Descartes. Let's see. Well, speaking, and a lot of the rationalist empiricist debate has to do with how much the senses play, how much of a role the senses play at all, or whether they play a role at all. And again, Plato would say you can't observe justice with your senses. You have to think about it in your mind, and then once you have a concept, you sort of think about what justice is, you intuit the form of justice, and then you can observe it in particular cases. And that's the rationalist idea, is that really knowledge is logical, it's conceptual, it's about how different ideas are related to one another, and it's not something you can observe, it's not something you can perceive.
And here I play the clip from The Matrix. Discussion follows.
So what does the pills represent?
Reality, like true, uncensored, unadulterated real world.
Uh-huh, like having knowledge of the real world. He said, what does he say? All I offer is the truth, nothing more. Yeah.
It represents the doorway to knowledge.
Good, doorway to knowledge. Somebody else had their hand up? Yeah.
It reminds me a lot of a cave. Because, I mean, like, if you were a cave prisoner, you had a choice. It would have been like the Red Pill or the Blue Pill. And it was just, as they pointed out, the doorway to knowledge and the doorway to true reality.
Uh-huh. So it's a choice, and the choice is between what? What is the? If you take the blue pill, what do you get?
Ignorance.
Yeah. Yeah, he says you believe whatever you want to believe, which is sort of, you know, what sorts of things would you want to believe?
The dream.
It happened. But none of that happened, and your reality is what you always thought it was.
Yeah, and you know, what's comfortable, what's pleasant, what is easy to believe, and the truth can be sort of harsh sometimes, and so people, you know, tend to believe things that are pleasant, that don't sort of upset the apple cart, that, don't embarrass them at parties, and they blurt out what they think. So, I mean, those sorts of things. This big sort of pull is between the kind of the common sense, everyday existence, and the preconceived beliefs, the traditional wisdom of every culture, as opposed to independent thought, rational judgment, trying to understand the truth and question all the beliefs of your society and even the beliefs that you have to see whether they're legitimate or not, to see whether they can stand up to rational scrutiny. So you can see there's a lot of overlap between Plato's cave, the Matrix here, and also Descartes' Meditations. So how might, and the screenwriters of this movie, you know, delved into philosophy and looked at Plato's cave and particularly Descartes' Meditations and drew their inspiration from both places. So what? How is Descartes related to this? The Matrix or the cave? How is he similar? Yeah.
Well, it's not trusting your senses as the Matrix, and it's more business kind of saying.
Mm-hmm.
Just accepting what you taste, touch, see, hear, or feel. Whereas the Matrix, it's on your thoughts and how you think. I mean, everything that he controls in the Matrix is through rationalism rather than his senses.
Mm-hmm. And a little louder, please, so it'll get picked up on the recording for those of you that want to participate. Yes.
I think that it works really well because it shows when he takes the red pill, he's shedding all of these beliefs that he's grown up with, and he's stepping into what is, in fact, the real world and gaining the knowledge that allows him to take the philosopher's journey. Mm-hmm. So it's really built around how Descartes conceptualized his own creation of the structure, the foundation for his beliefs. It's amazingly representative.
Well put. Somebody else? Yeah.
So I feel like it's like in the first meditation where Descartes is explaining that the rational mind is something that needs to be let go of, so we can actually perceive the foundation, so we can start rebuilding our conception of God, rather than having these preconceived notions of this material illusion that we've built up around us. In relation to the matrix, we can see that this concept of the matrix is an illusion that we've been programmed to believe, and it's being able to step away from that to actually see reality as we understand it.
And I think everything about that was accurate, except for the beginning where you said the rational mind. I think Descartes would say the rational mind is the way to knowledge, and Plato would say the rational mind is the way out of the cave. And so for all these rationalist philosophers, they would say that it's reason and logic and asking rational questions, and particularly questioning your senses, that will give you knowledge. Yeah.
But with that in mind, using the allegory of the cave, wouldn't the rational mind try to justify these images as something that is not necessarily going to be these objects that are fictitious, mm-hmm. as opposed to actually being real objects in space and time?
I think that Plato would say that that's more like your feelings getting in the way. You like the pleasantness of your preconceived notions, and so you look for maybe ways to justify them, but that's not really using reason and logic. That's using your feelings to try to convince yourself that things that question your beliefs aren't really true or don't matter. Yeah.
Early on, Descartes presents the theory of a parts deceiver, of a brain in a vacuum, and I was just noticing that's definitely paralleled in the Matrix with all of the bodies and parts and the machines as the arts deceivers.
Right, for those of you who haven't seen it, I don't know if I'll ruin it for anybody.
Spoilers. Movie from 1999.
Yeah, but it's, I suppose you could say, well, if you haven't seen it now, but, you know, some people, they might have been 10 years old when this came out, so... or seven, yeah, or something like that. So, the reality is very different, and there is a sort of, you know, conspiracy to keep people in the dark, much like the cave, and people are, you know, they're not chained up, but they're in these pods, used by aliens. Did I make a reference to this last class? But it's kind of the one, I think it was a brilliant screenplay, but they have this really hokey premise that the aliens are using this as a power source, like a third grade science experiment. Like you take the lemon and you put the electrodes in it.
Well, it's science fiction. You have to suspend your disbelief. And it's machines, not aliens.
It's the future, too. You know, maybe human brains develop more energy.
Oh, you're right. It is machines. I've conflated with another movie. But... There's two kinds of science fiction. There's like hard science fiction that actually tries to do a little fact-checking and do something reasonably plausible and extrapolate science. And then there's the sort of the sloppy science fiction where you have like a totally unbelievable premise where it's hard to... I don't know if L. Ron was so bad, but maybe there's a difference of opinion there. But the whole human beings as living batteries seemed kind of ridiculous to me. But I still think it's, given that flaw, it's still a brilliant screenplay and hits on a lot of these deeper philosophical issues. So let's jump back to Descartes then. So Descartes has a kind of a matrix-like moment where he... sort of accidentally takes the red pill. What goes on there? He
talks about this experience he has that's sort of his wake-up moment. Yes.
When he realizes that his waking life could be a dream.
Uh-huh. And what incident sparks that?
When he's sitting in front of a fireplace and writing on his parchment, and then wakes up and realizes he's in bed, like, not anywhere near a fire, completely undressed, and thinks to himself, wasn't I just writing in front of the fire?
Mm-hmm.
And that was like the whole like, Matrix experience.
Yeah,
he actually talks about how he can feel the warmth of the fire on his back and actually witness the words like, coming onto the paper, and then he wakes up like says naked in his bed, like wasn't I just like he said by the fire writing down something? And yeah, it's kind of just like he realizes that there's certain distinctions that you must make to realize that you're in your dream state or actually in reality.
Well, and but the whole question, I think he does. I mean, you described the experience well, but his deduction isn't like, well, there's got to be like some way to tell like whether you're dream, whether I'm dreaming or whether I sleep. The question was, how do I know I'm not dreaming right now, right? Because when I was just had that experience, you know, I could feel the warmth of the fire. You know, I'm writing on the paper, and all my senses are telling me that this is what's happening around me. And then all of a sudden, it turns out I'm not by the fire. I'm in my cold bedchamber. I'm wearing my night clothes. I'm laying flat on my bed. I'm not in a chair. And so all my sensory beliefs were false. So then the question is, how can I ever trust my senses if they misled me in this one, you know, incident? And then he talks about other cases in which your senses mislead you. And the idea is that if the senses are unreliable, why should you rely on them? Or how can you rely on them? Any thoughts about that? About his dream? This, sometimes it's just called the dream argument. And there's actually ways to tell whether you're dreaming or not. Anybody know about this?
Pinch?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Look at your watch.
Yeah, what's that? Look at your watch. Yeah.
Is it true that you can't change light levels in dreams? Like if you flip a light switch in your dream, the light won't change?
I know, I never tried that before.
I heard that you can't like see your feet and stuff like that too.
I see my feet. What's that? Yeah, but like in the dream, like you throw a bucket of water in yourself or whatever and you're wet.
You can realize, I mean, if you have a lucid dream, you can realize that you're dreaming. It's rationalism. Like right now, I can rationalize that I'm not dreaming for sure because I mean, if I was reading Plato or Descartes, I think that I'm not dreaming. I'm not dreaming. But in a dream, I can realize that I'm dreaming and control it. Do whatever I please, like fly around or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, so, that's not rational.
So it's not rational to be able to fly around? But how do you know, like, when you're dreaming, that's not the real world, and that when you're awake, that it's the fake world? I mean, that's the question Descartes might ask.
There are theories that our waking life is actually a deeper state of rest than our dream time is. So with that in mind, I mean, our dream time can be a more feasible reality because we're not restricted. I mean, science is proven that we can use 10% of our times. With that in mind, as we are restricted in this form, in our dream state, we don't have the restrictions that we force ourselves to have in this supposedly time.
And I think you might look at Descartes as not talking about like REM states or something, but talking about maybe life isn't like a literal dream, like you're, you know, having rapid eye movement or something, or your brain is doing some weird thing, but that life might be something like a dream, in that your life might be unreal, and at any moment you might wake up like you did from this dream, and maybe you could have a dream within a dream. So during ordinary existence, you just sort of, you know, you wake up, you go to sleep, you say, well, the dream's fake, and real life is real, and then, but then you might have this further waking up and realize, wait, just like in the Matrix, you know, people went to sleep and they woke up, right? But all their belief system was completely false, and reality was totally different than they thought, than they experienced it. And that's kind of Descartes' argument here, is how do you know, not, I mean, if you focus on some particular fact of how you can tell dreams from reality, there might be a way, if you practiced it, to figure out whether you're dreaming or not. But you know, when you're a dream, you might say, well, it's easy because, like, if I dream I'm being chased by a monster, I know that there's no such thing as monsters, and so I can say, oh, that's a dream. But when you're in the dream, you don't say, oh, that's a monster, this must be a dream. You say, oh, no, a monster, right? And you run away. So it's like when you're in that state, you can't really tell. And it just takes like one, right? So even if you're able to figure out that you're dreaming some of the time, it's just like that one super vivid dream that you're really sure at that moment that it's not a dream. You know, that might not be enough to generate some skepticism about your how things appear to you, and how you know that what appears to you is what's true in reality. And that's the question that Descartes' asking here. And particularly, again, he's questioning sense beliefs here. Sensation. How do you know your sensation is accurate? And he talks about a couple of different cases. Let's move on to the arch deceiver argument, which is the second argument. So suppose you can tell the difference between dreams and reality. What if there's a being who's just like... Could you guys stop talking there? That side conversation is distracting me. So if the arch deceiver, he says, what if there's a being just like God, only evil? And he is trying to fool us all the time. That's what he loves to do. He's like, I'm going to create some false beliefs. I'm going to make these dupes believe something that's totally different than reality is. You think about God as sort of an evil practical joker, right? And the world is like his scare tactics or whatever. He like does all these things. He likes hoaxing people. He puts in the dinosaur bones to make people believe in evolution, and big monsters that rule the earth and so on, and people believe in evolution. Or he might, you know, make people think they're being abducted by aliens or what have you, right? So he might do all these crazy things. But his idea is that he's going to make you believe false things, and that's what gives him joy. Now, Descartes says, how would you ever know that there isn't such a being? Or could you prove that there isn't such a being? And if you can't, how do you justify any of your beliefs now that are based largely on your senses? So what do you think?
Well, it seems like if most people believe that there's like a quote-unquote God that does all these good things, that it would be just as logical that there's like an antithesis or opposite of that. So, I mean, why wouldn't there be?
Yeah, the basic argument is there might... Suppose there's an omnipotent being who's all-powerful and all-knowledgeable. You know, he's omnipotent, omniscient, but he's also evil. And he's trying to fool you. Then how would you know such a being didn't exist? If you can't prove such a being doesn't exist, then how do you know? How can you accept any of your beliefs as true or know that they're true? Yeah?
It may not be a terribly compelling argument, but I'd have to wonder why such an all-powerful being would care, and especially if he does his job too well and logs of Gulliver and buy into it, wouldn't he get bored? Why would he care about keeping up pretenses?
Wouldn't he get bored? Maybe he just really enjoys it. I think like working on cars is boring, but some people really find it pleasurable. Some people, they love baseball. I think it's boring as hell. But people, they're there glued to the TV set, you know, watching the pitcher scratch his cup, you know, and wait for the pitch. And I'm like, oh God, just, you know, hang me now. And it's horrible. But some people really enjoy it. Maybe who knows the ways of the arch deceiver? His ways are not our ways.
Yes,
there you go, artsy. And if he's omniscient, how can we even understand the way his mind works if he's all-knowing? So we might not know why he delights in deceiving people, but does that mean that he doesn't? Yeah.
See, I really like this thought form. It's really almost insidious to have like some omniscient being just created for the simple fact of disillusioning people. But wouldn't that mean that he's just trying to wake people up? Because once you realize that you're wrong, rational thoughts or rational people would try to correct that false thought, you know?
life. So it could be that like this omniscient being isn't necessarily negative force as Descartes or we perceive it to be, so much as a positive force trying to wake us up from the illusion of desire.
I suppose that's possible, right? What if Descartes would say, okay, that's another possibility, but he would say that there's also the possibility of the evil one that doesn't want us to know anything. And if it is the evil one that doesn't want us to know anything, and he's a million times smarter than anybody, then how would you ever know? I mean, if he wants to keep you in the dark, you're going to be in the dark, because there's no way to outsmart him, because he's a super genius, and you're just like a paltry human being. Maybe he created you for the very purpose of being ignorant and fooling, right? It's like, like a kid trying to outsmart his parents or something like that. Like not maybe like a 4-year-old. Or it's like my cat trying to outsmart me, right? It's not going to happen because I'm a lot smarter than he is. So what is Descartes actually says, if you think about, okay, so let's imagine there's this arch deceiver, he's intent on deceiving me. Is there anything he couldn't fool me about? And he asks this question, could the arch deceiver... Oh, go ahead.
Oh, can you just, like, doubt what he tells you to believe and start trying to, like, if, say, you can't say, like, I don't know, something that the arch deceiver says, and you can't doubt it, there's no way to tear it apart. Uh-huh. Would you just try to accept it as true? Well, try and doubt everything he tells you.
Well, he's not really telling you things. He just sort of sets up the world, and you know, it's like the Matrix world or something like that. He like feeds you fake experiences. He tells you you're eating a cheeseburger and that you're, you know, riding the bus or, you know, whatever, you're going about your life, and in reality, you know, you're floating in a pod someplace, right? Or and there's actually a modern version of this, the brain in the vat argument. And the brain of the vat argument just tries to get rid of like things like people say, well, we know we've never had an experience of like a disembodied mind, and so that's kind of not really plausible. And so, okay, well, we could go with the sciencey version, right? And we'll say it's like the Matrix world, and there's some aliens, and the aliens are trying to, even though in the Matrix it's artificial intelligences, but imagine like the aliens and the have your brain in a vat. And you like know nothing. You keep on getting experiences. Like if you think about the way the brain works, right, you could be like in a vat. And if you like, you know, your normal brain, like in your skull, you've got eyeballs there, and the eyeballs receive light, you know, from the outside world. Say you're like seeing a tree, right? And then the light bounces on your retina and it turns around and it creates these nerve impulses and little electrical impulses. You know, like coded electrical impulses go along your optic nerve and they go into your brain and sort of dance around, and you get the idea of the tree in your mind. Well, we could just like cut out the middleman, right? And instead of like real eyeballs and the real tree, we could just like send that electrical impulse from a computer. My computer. Right, it's an alien computer, so it's like our computers, right? And it could be like, you know, weird, you know, aliens from the planet Zontar sort of look like floating jellyfish, and the guys from the old video games are, you know, with big rows of nasty teeth, are operating the controls. How would you know any different?
Flying spaghetti.
There you go. Well, this is like, these are like, you know, realistic, you know, actual aliens from another planet, right? So, how would you, I mean, and again, how would you ever know? Because there's no difference between seeing, in your mind, there's no difference between seeing an actual tree and the experience you would get if someone sent those same electrical impulses from a computer. I mean, the easy way to do it would be, you know, aliens who have hundreds of years of technology ahead of us, just metering, like putting a little device in and watching like what happens when you see a tree, and then taking those electrical impulses and reproducing them, and you would see a tree if they sent those in the same part of your brain where your optic nerve is attached. Whether it's your brain in the vat or whether it's the aliens, could they... the aliens in the brain of the vat, or whether it's the arch deceiver, is there anything the arch deceiver couldn't fool you about? Yeah.
Your existence?
Yeah. So Descartes says, try as hard as you might, the arch deceiver can't fool you into believing that you don't exist. Now, why is that? Yeah?
Because you're the object of the deception.
Yeah, so if you're being deceived, then it follows logically that you exist as the object of deception. Because if you didn't exist, then there would be nobody who's being deceived. So Descartes says, the one belief which you can't possibly doubt is, I exist. And this is put famously in the phrase, what's the phrase?
I think therefore I am.
There you go, I think therefore I am. And it means, if I'm thinking, there has to be a thinker. I exist as a thinking thing. If I think, I have to exist as a vehicle of thought. And try as hard as you might, the arch deceiver can never fool me into thinking I'm nothing when I'm something. And so just the very fact that I'm aware of my own consciousness shows that I exist as some sort of a conscious being. And for Descartes, this is the starting place for knowledge. So what do you think about this as a first step?
Gotta start somewhere.
Yeah.
You need something kind of nice.
Yeah, I'm aware of my own existence, therefore
I actually still have the recollection and distinctly of being in my mother's womb. And I can't speak for anybody else, but my recollection, I can definitely remember not just the awareness of being that you are.
Mm-hmm.
You're something. You don't know what you are, of course, in the womb. You don't really have any knowledge other than that, because you haven't been born yet, so you don't have the flow of data input in your brain.
Yes, so that would be like an experience of your own existence, the very first one? Sure.
But you definitely have the awareness of being something.
And so your self-consciousness. Yeah.
But what if that is the ultimate deception, that we exist?
Yeah, that's a good question. So what could you... maybe expand on that a little bit. How could you be mistaken about whether you exist or not?
Well, I mean, like, let's say this is the arch deceiver, the ultimate deceiver of all things.
Right.
And we, as insignificant mites, have no ability to perceive outside of what illusion it designs for us.
Okay.
How could we ever conceive that we do exist? Unless it wants us to understand that we exist.
Well, if you're a mite, then you exist, right? Even if you're a mite.
But, I mean, that's just, like, it programming us to believe that we are that mite.
But if you've been programmed to believe that you're a mite, then you exist. And Descartes would say, no matter what you are, if you're saying, well, suppose, what if you're this way? What if you're that way? Well, if you were anyway, you would exist. So it doesn't say that you have a material body necessarily, or that there's a material world, or that it's anything close to what we believe it is, but it just shows that you as an individual exists. And it doesn't even mean that anybody else exists too, right? It could be that you're the only being that exists and everybody else is a figment of your imagination. That's also possible. So it's this first person, I think, therefore I am. You guys can talk about that further in the forum. That's Descartes' first step towards knowledge. And so once he proves he exists, then what's the next logical step? What would you do? Like, okay, you've proved you exist. Now what would you try to prove next? Yeah.
Proving that your physical reality exists?
Yeah, that might seem like a good next step. What's Descartes' next step? Well, he comes back to the arch deceiver, but he actually tries to prove God exists. So, okay, you proved you exist, now you got to prove God exists. That wouldn't be the first thing I would do, but you can see as he goes on, there's a kind of method to his madness. And so he thinks that if he can prove that God exists and is no deceiver, that there isn't an arch deceiver, but instead there's an actual God, then if God is good, then God wouldn't deceive us. And therefore, we can have confidence in our senses. And that's the broad outline of Descartes' argument. So he proves that he exists, that God exists, not in one, not in two, but three different ways that he tries to prove God's existence. And then once he's proved that God exists and is no deceiver, then he proves that you can... you can have knowledge of the world. And he even says you can kind of trust your senses somewhat, but you know, don't put too much stock in them. And really, knowledge comes through reason. And if God is really good, he wouldn't deceive you. So what do you think about that as an argument? Oh, we're almost at that time here.
Deceive us.
And since we had our Martin Luther King holiday, we don't have a lot of time to go over the arguments. I think I might hit a couple of them on Monday. It actually falls at a different place, so we'll probably have more time for Locke. So just think about these arguments. He makes three basic arguments for God's existence. Imagine like that just one of them works. So the question is, if just one of those works, does his whole program work out? In other words, if you have God exists, can you prove that God is good, and therefore if God is good, he wouldn't deceive us, and therefore knowledge is possible? So that's sort of his idea. So think about whether or not that's going to work or not. I might post another question to the forums, or I might just wait till next week. I'll have to look at our schedule and see what I'm going to do next. I think that's it for today. Go forth and think about the red pill and the blue pill. And don't forget to post before Sunday night, 11:55 p.m.